chance to hear that interview with Sir James Galway in a much more substantive form now. I've been speaking to him as part of BBC Music Day, which is a nationwide celebration aiming to bring together generations and communities through their love of music. And as part of it, the day-long events, there will be a celebration of music from Belfast's Crumlin Road Jail tonight, featuring an array of artists, including Sir James Galway. So he came into the BBC Radio Ulster studio yesterday with his flute in hand, and I asked him what that instrument meant to him.
Well, it's sort of my life, you know. That's what I do. I'm a flute player, and I've been doing it since I was a kid, since I was about nine.
9 years of age. Can you remember the first moment you held one?
No.
That's a long time ago,
well,
right?
Well, you see, my dad played the flute. So when he would practice at home, we would always try and have a blow on it.
Uh-huh.
So I can't remember the first time I actually got my hands on a flute and got going.
But you remember your dad playing?
Oh, yeah.
Was he good?
I remember my granddad. He was good.
Right. Okay. So it's not in the direct genes then? Your dad wasn't great. It wasn't as if you looked at your dad and you thought, I want to do that.
Well, no, when I say he wasn't good, I mean, that's judging him by a wrong standard. Hmm. By the standards of his peers, he was good.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And at what stage then did you think to yourself, I really like this, I'm good at this?
I don't know. It was like having a computer game. To see if you could get it right. Mm-hmm. You know, this week you do the scale of G. Mm-hmm. Next week you do the scale of D. And then as you get one frame fixed, you go to the next frame.
And was this at quite an early age that you started really trying to perfect it? Because children...
Yeah, about nine or ten, you know.
You were trying to perfect it?
Well, it depends what you mean perfect. I was just trying to get something right.
Yeah.
I mean, I was trying to play it in D major without any mistakes. Or I was learning my little march that I played with the Onward Flute Band to see if I could get through that without making a mess.
Do you not think that's slightly unusual? That a child usually finds it difficult to focus at that age? So that would suggest there was something drawing you to it.
I don't know. I don't know about that. I mean, there were other kids in our street who played other instruments, but they also did other things. I didn't do the other things because I have rather poor eyesight. So I didn't play football because I couldn't see the ball until it was gone past. And then I remember once, but we used to go over to the Grove from Mount Collier School, and we play cricket over there and stuff like that. And I remember I was the last man in for cricket. And I was for sure never going to play cricket, you see. Uh-huh. So I used to sit there and noodle on a flute. And during one cricket match, I actually got in. So all these guys all said, Jimmy, you miss it, we're going to kill you. So somebody bowled one and I took a swipe at it and it went for miles.
Brilliant.
That was my cricket career over in a flash.
That's one of your memories then as a kid, though.
Yeah, right? Oh, sure.
Right. It's funny the way things stick in your mind as a child. I'm fat now. I was a fat kid, and I remember one time I was always goalkeeper because I couldn't run around the pitch. And I was standing between the nets, and someone shot, and whatever way I tried to dive, it was quite a good dive, and I saved the ball. I saved the goal, and that memory's imprinted in my head.
Yeah,
was your childhood a happy childhood?
Oh yeah, sure. I mean, we all grew up in the lower working class, the same as Jesus. He was a working class kid too. Yeah. And, I mean, he didn't know he was poor. We didn't know we were poor. We just did what we did.
Mm.
You know, for dinner, we'd probably have champ. That was it. And maybe at the weekend, we might get a piece of meat or during the week, a sausage with a potato, but we weren't rich. Or
and how much did your poor eyesight affect you as a child?
Well, it affected me badly because I always had to sit at the front of the class so I could see what was on the blackboard. Mm. Because I couldn't see it. And you see, in those days, They didn't do anything. If you had a nystagmus, which I have, they didn't.
What's
give
that
you,
mean? What is that?
It means that the muscles on one side are not equal to the other side, and when you're trying to focus, the muscles pull it over to one side, and the other muscles say, "Hey, wait a minute," and they pull it back. You see, so it's constantly moving. And a lot of people think it's fun, you know, but it really isn't fun. You know, you have to refocus every time when you're reading a book.
Often when there's something different about you when you're a child, it means that you're in some ways isolated. Did that happen to you?
Yes, it did, because there's a lot of things we didn't do. Like, I didn't play football. I didn't play cricket. And these things were big around about where we lived.
Did that mean you were the odd man out?
Well, no, nobody saw it like that. I mean, you were not branded as an odd man out. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just accepted the fact that I played the flute, they played soccer.
Brilliant. And that progressed, so here you are, you've already told us, so that progressed to, at a pretty early age, you were trying to get things right, trying to get things right. At what stage do you reckon you cracked it? Like, where in
your
life?
There is no stage. You're still cracking it.
Yeah, but come on.
No. Look, Al Pacino, in an interview on TV, described being King Lear in Boston. So opening night, and he did his bit. Next morning, he got slated. And you see, he said to the interviewer, you know, each professional actor like me, we know five Shakespeare plays or so from memory. Mm-hmm. He said, that doesn't mean to say you can act them. He said, we know them. And he said, it wasn't until about the 83rd performance that he walked on the stage and he felt he was the king. You see, and then he really delivered.
Right, so there you go. So he felt it at some stage.
So you have to practice is the thing. Repetition is the thing.
Yeah. But you've been practicing all your life then.
Yes, that's right. But you have to do it all the time anyway. Because if you don't practice, you lose everything that you were striving for.
And so at what stage did you think to yourself, my goodness, I'm one of the best in the world at this?
There is no stage like that. You see, I don't care about all the other flute players. I'm not trying to play better than them.
Really? You're not competitive?
No. I'm just trying to play better than James Galway. That's it. I don't care what those guys do or where they're at. Their standard doesn't interest me so much as my standard, my personal standard.
Does that mean you put yourself under a lot of pressure?
No, not really. You just practice. You know, you get the flute out and you see what we've got to do today.
This is a loaded question, Jimmy, because this is clearly your passion. As you said at the very beginning, this is your life. But does it get to a stage ever that you can't actually be bothered anymore?
No.
You've played it for so long.
Look at this. When you're a kid, your mother taught you how to say the Lord's Prayer, right? But it didn't mean anything, did it? But maybe if you kept repeating it over the years, it might mean something. It might become part of your conversation with God. Whereas before it didn't, you just repeated that. And it's the same with the flute. You just got to keep practicing till you get certain things falling in line. And I mean, even though I know a Mozart concerto from memory, played it dozens of times, I still practice it because I know that there's nothing like taking something for granted for making a mess.
What's the feeling like inside when you're playing that instrument you love?
Oh, good. I have a good feeling and I enjoy manipulating it as you go along.
How do you manipulate it?
Example, you often hear singers when they sing and they hit a top note and it's not quite there, but they push it till it gets, and you think, wow, listen to that. You see, but if you listen to it repeatedly, you can hear that they didn't really get the note dead on the nose, but they pushed it and moved it around till it became perfect.
Will you play something for us today?
Yeah, sure. We're going to be playing Brian Boru's March, so here it is.
You've mentioned during this interview on a number of occasions, Sir James, you're, well, God. How important is faith to you?
Very. I mean, you know, you don't get a gift like mine for nothing. And this gift that I have, I make sure that I'm going to really... I mean, I would feel embarrassed in front of God to think that I played bad just because I didn't practice. I would be embarrassed. Now, you wouldn't want to be embarrassed in front of God, would you?
Why are you sure God exists?
Well, if you believe in Christ and in the reincarnation, then you know it exists.
Have you always believed?
Well, more or less, when I was a kid, I went to church, you know. But I just went because that was the thing to do. And then later on, I started to go to church and I realized that these sermons sometimes were better than others. So I began to seek out a church where the priest or the preacher was really good. Mm. So that's what I do now. When I go to New York, I go and hear Tim Keller speaking. He's a very good speaker. And I rather enjoy it.
And does that give you then a contentment in life that you believe in this higher force? You believe in something that's bigger than life on here?
Yes. Now, for example, people don't think they've been here before. There's a lot of people think that's a load of rubbish.
So what do you, Sir James, think you were before?
Me? I don't know.
Well, if you believe in it, you must have thought about it.
Yeah, but no, I don't know what I was before. Maybe I was a musician or something. I don't know.
Well, you're a musician now, so you must have been something else before.
Well, not necessarily. You might come back to get it right.
I just got a sense when you talked there about if you were in front of your God, how embarrassing it would be if you didn't practice every day. So to a certain extent, your faith puts you under pressure. If you think you have a gift, and you clearly do have a gift, to perform.
Yeah.
So you're not performing for yourself. You're performing so that you don't let God down.
Yes, that's right.
But that's how do you enjoy that then?
Well, I do. I do. I enjoy at the end of a thing.
That means you're performing out of fear, Sir James, to hit a level every time.
No, not really. I've never been afraid.
Because it comes naturally.
Well, no, it doesn't come naturally. It's a lot of hard work.
I asked you earlier if you have any ambition left.
Well, ambition is a very curious thing. You see, I'm different. I'm not ambitious. But I just want to get it right. And I want to get it right in front of the person who gave me this gift.
But you've sold over 30 million albums.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, there's a lot of people, even today, there are people writing in on Twitter and things like this.
Have you got a Twitter account?
Me, I have, but I don't even know the password.
You're not into Twitter?
No, I'm not into it, but I think I should get into it.
Yeah.
But this person said something like, I like Metallica and James Galway rocks. So you see, you get people Brilliant. Like this every day who are just listening to my records.
So why do you think it is that you have been able to reach such a wide audience? Have you analysed that?
Yes. Yes. I think I was one of the first people to try to get through the barrier, the stuffy sort of barrier. You know, that we had, like the BBC had a certain approach, which was a very, I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say stuffy.
Well,
posh.
There's got to be another word for it, posh. It's, I don't know.
Aloof.
Word. Yeah, maybe.
I've encountered this barrier myself.
And you see, when I come along and I just don't care about it and I'm going to play any song and it sells a couple of million records, well, that's a good thing. Well done. And you see, it requires the same sort of technique, the same sort of dedication to play a simple song like any song well.
Mm. Is money important to you? Do you like being rich?
Well, I'm not rich, I can tell you that.
You've sold 30 million albums and you're not rich?
Yeah, well, you get ripped off on the way, you know.
Honestly, you're not rich?
No. You're on the way along.
I thought you would have been a multi-millionaire.
Man, I wish I was.
Is that not irritating?
Well, it is irritating, that along the way, certain things like banks, you know, you invest your fortune and they call you up and say, well, we've had a dip in the thing, and now instead of having 10 million, you've only got 7. Mm. And that keeps going till it gets down to nearly 1 when you think, I'm going to buy a shoebox and stick it all under the bed.
So did you lose a fortune in a financial crash?
Oh, yes.
In the most recent one?
No.
So in other words, what happened to you has happened again? You've seen it before.
Over and over again. I mean, the biggest one was in the dot-com crash.
And was that where you lost yours?
Yeah. And I told them to sell it, and they said, let's hang on for a day or two to see what happens, and that's what happened.
Did you lose millions?
Yes.
How do you cope with that?
Oh. What do you mean? How do you cope with it?
I mean...
I'm not in love with money.
I mean, are you the type who can say within hours or days, that's life, I'll move on, or did it bug you?
It bugs me right at on the nose, but after you get past that, there's nothing to do about it. I mean, what can you do about these situations?
What do you make of bankers?
Well, it's very difficult to say. I think they're all out for themselves and they're really not there to serve the customers.
Why do you think Northern Ireland is special, if you do? And do you miss not living here?
Yeah, I like the way the people talk, you know. They always have a wee word for it,
yeah.
If you see what I mean.
Do you keep across politics here?
No, I'm not into politics. I don't keep up with them because...
But you know that Northern Ireland's a better place now, obviously. That there's relative peace now.
Yeah, I do. I do. But on the other hand, you know, when you look at all this whole stuff, whoever wins the day, if it happens to be a bunch of thugs... Do you want to really live in a society that they rule?
What do you mean?
Well...
Who are the thugs?
Well, the killers.
But who do you mean?
Well, I'm not sure who I mean because I'm not sure who's actually doing the killing. But whoever comes out on top, I would not want to be part of it. I mean, for example, in Germany, you would not like to be ruled by Nazis. You see, and we might have been if it had not been for Winston Churchill sticking to his guns.
You know, I just want to be clear as to what you mean. How are they likened to the Nazis?
I didn't say they were likened to the Nazis.
So what are you saying? I'm just trying to clarify.
I'm not sure what I'm saying because nobody brought me into this sort of
conversation
before.
Sure.
And it's, you know...
It's interesting because we all care about Northern Ireland, don't we?
Yeah.
And we look at the present situation.
I see what you mean. But wouldn't you say that it is immoral for one country to take over another country just because the other country is not so well armed? Wouldn't you think that was immoral? Well, let me put this to you. Would you not think that 800 years ago what the British did was immoral and it kept doing it and it's still immoral? Hmm. I mean, I'm not I would like Ireland to be Ireland. And when people ask me, where do you come from? I said, Ireland. They said, oh, you're Irish. I say, yes, I'm Irish.
You don't consider yourself to be Northern Irish?
No. I'm Irish.
What's the difference?
It's very complicated. Very complicated. They say, well, how do you become a sir? I said, well, because I come from the British occupied part of Ireland.
Okay.
You see? And then, you see, when I grew up, we grew up as Protestants and we were brainwashed to the Protestant ethic and to their way of thinking. For example, we knew all the sites of London, Trafalgar Square and Buckingham Palace and all that, but we didn't know Stormont.
Brainwashed by whom?
Well, by the people who, actually by the Presbyterians who made the school systems separate. If they'd all been together in the first place, we may not have so many problems. But I believe they were the ones who made it so that one, if you were Catholic, you got a good education from the Jesuits. And if you weren't, you got a second class one from somebody else.
What would make Northern Ireland a better place?
Oh.
How do we resolve this the past that we have, these differences that we have?
I think, well, the education system has to stop, and it has to be Catholics, Protestants, Presbyterians, everybody together, all under the same roof.
Or maybe, and I know you're not going to agree with this, or maybe actually religion causes more division, and if more people became less religious, there would be less conflict.
Let's talk about Ian Paisley. Now, he was a religious leader. How many people do you think he was responsible for killing indirectly by planting the thoughts of violence and no surrender in the heads of people who had no more sense?
How many people do you think?
I don't know. That's a question.
Well, the inference is you think he was responsible for some.
Well, I'm sure he was because, I mean, he wasn't exactly preaching let's all live together, was he?
He was the man, Sir James, who, towards the end of his political career, no doubt his family would argue, took a very courageous step to sit down with Martin McGuinness.
Maybe
and all the risk that comes with that.
Maybe he didn't have any choice. I mean, it might have gotten to that.
Do you admire Paisley and McGuinness for what they've done?
Well, I never admired Paisley ever because I think he was on paper a man of God, but in reality, I don't think he was. I mean, how could you justify setting one side against another?
Who are you to judge, Sir James, whether someone is a man of God? That's not for you to judge, is it?
Well, no, it's not. It's not.
Really interesting territory we've got into. If we come back to the reason you walked into the studio, today is BBC Music Day.
Yeah, I didn't expect to talk about all this stuff,
I
can tell you.
Welcome to the Nolan Show. And BBC Music Day is a nationwide celebration, and it's aimed at bringing together generations and communities, which actually does have an association with what we've just been talking about there. How do we get communities coming together?
Oh.
And BBC Music Day is about coming together through a love of music.
That's right.
How effective is it?
I don't know, because, I mean, musicians don't actually ask each other what they believe in. They just get down and do it.
Yeah.
And they go and hang out afterwards and they enjoy being together. They enjoy the moment. They enjoy playing music for an audience. They enjoy the fact that the audience appreciates their hard work.
And you're giving your time to this?
Yes.
Why?
Because I believe in it.
And you believe in the next generation? You believe
Oh, yes.
Why? Final question.
Well, I think there are some very clever kids out there, not necessarily doing music, but in fact doing music and doing all sorts of other things, like all sorts of scientific things that have to do with the use of computing.
It's been really interesting meeting you today, sir. And thank you very much for doing so.
Thank you.
So, I can tell you now that Sir James Galway is trending on Twitter throughout the UK. A celebration of music from Belfast Crumlin Road Jail as part of BBC Music Day will be simultaneously broadcast tonight from 9 o'clock on BBC 2NI and BBC Radio Ulster. It will also be available behind the red button at 10 o'clock. Thanks for your company today.